Welcome to Eastern Standard and episode 27 of our special series, Democracy Optimist.
What does it mean to be American?
It's one thing to hear that we need to become more involved in the civic affairs of our communities, but figuring out how and what we can offer can be a challenge, and that's the focus of our series host, University of Kentucky Election Law and Voting Rights Research Professor Joshua Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we discuss the current state of American democracy, recognizing the risks it faces today, while still offering a glimmer of hope along the way. Many of us want to do something, anything, to foster civic engagement and democracy, especially when things feel like they're spiraling out of control. I am asked all the time what people can do to help sustain democracy. Of course, we should vote, but Election Day can feel far off. What can we do every day or each week that will make a practical difference? Enter Citizen University. What started as a two-day conference in Seattle over a decade ago has turned into a nationwide movement to help people foster powerful, responsible citizenship in communities all across America. As its website, citizenuniversity.us, states, its dream is a country in which Americans are steeped in a sense of civic character, educated in the tools of civic power, and are problem-solving contributors in a self-governing community. Here to discuss the work of Citizen University is one of its co-founders, Eric Liu. He's thought a lot about what it means to be an engaged citizen. He's the author of Become America, Civic Sermons on Love, Responsibility, and Democracy. And he has a new book coming out in the fall titled Live Like a Citizen, 8 Ways to Change Your Mindset and Our Country. Eric, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Josh, I'm so glad to be here.
So tell us about Citizen University. How did this 2-day conference turn into a nonprofit organization and ultimately a nationwide movement?
Well, I think, in a way that is hopefully pretty consistent with the things that we try to teach, which is bottom up, emergently, rooted in people's needs and feelings, but also connected to the ways that they live in their communities. And our work at Citizen University is all about trying to strengthen the civic culture of real places in our country. I think one of the challenges, and you know this well, as somebody who is a national expert on national politics and voting rights issues and so forth, and at the same time rooted in a place. You are deeply involved in the civic life of Kentucky and Lexington and other kind of aspects of your region. And, you know, we live in a time right now where so much of civic and political life has been nationalized. And what Citizen University tries to do is to teach people the basics of how to reclaim their power, their voice, and their sense of responsibility in the places where they live in a way that's rooted in place and is relational. And I can tell you more about some of the programs as we go, but that's our general thrust. And it grew out of this conference because as we started offering workshops and learning experiences for people from all over the country, we realized the demand for this was so much greater than we realized. And the web of people like you who are catalyzing change in the places where they live is so much vaster than people realize. And we felt like we had both an opportunity and responsibility to start connecting these dots.
I want to talk more about those programs that you mentioned. There's two that caught my eye, Power Plus Character Educator Training and Civic Saturday Fellowship. Tell us a little bit about either those or some of the other programming that you're most proud of.
Yeah, you bet. I'll start first with Civic Saturday, because that's maybe one of the things we're best known for. Civic Saturday started back in 2016, 17. And what they are essentially is a civic analog to a faith gathering. It's not church, it's not synagogue or mosque, but on purpose, it has the structure and the flow and the arc and the feel of that kind of gathering, but directed toward our commitment to each other in civic life. And we've chosen that format and that kind of ritual container, if you will, because we believe, not metaphorically, but quite literally, that democracy requires our mutual belief Democracy only works if enough of us believe democracy works. And that mutual belief, that civic faith, has to be kindled. It can't be, as you said in your introductory remarks, just a once every 4 or once every 2 years kind of deal. It is about how we show up. It's how we move mindfully in community. It's how we see each other. And so we created these gatherings in which people, strangers, come into a space. They are greeted, welcomed. You sit down next to somebody. You're invited to kind of talk about something that cuts right through small talk, a prompt that's about the hopes and the fears in your community. There are readings of texts that you might think of as civic scripture, drawn from throughout our American tradition, whether it's super well-known things like the Gettysburg Address or the preamble to the Constitution, or less-known texts. And then someone will give a civic sermon to try to help make sense of this moment and what it's like in Lexington or Tacoma, Washington, or Akron, Ohio, to be navigating these times. And then at the end, people form into circles, civic circles, to really think about how they're going to convert the inspiration and the provocation of that gathering into committed action in their communities. And so we started these in Seattle, where I'm from, where the co-founder of Citizen University, my late wife, Janae Kane, we are rooted here. But these gatherings started to spread all over the country, and we started training people from all over the country to lead them. And so that's what the Civic Saturday Fellowship is.
Let me ask you about that. If I wanted to start one of these civic fellowships here in Lexington, or let's say people in Louisville, Kentucky, what practical things should we do to actually start something like this?
Yeah, well, two things. Number one, for many years, we ran, I think, 20 plus, almost 30 cohorts of people. It's over 300 people we've trained from all over the country, big cities, small towns, rural places, almost every state in the union. And we would bring them to Seattle for a week of immersive training, both in the how do you do this, how do you organize this kind of gathering, but more than the how, the why it matters, why it's important to kind of get steeped in the ideas of our civic creed, in our ideals, and what it means to actually close the gap between our creed and our deeds. And so we do these deep trainings. We're now in the midst of shifting, actually, where instead of bringing folks to Seattle, we are looking for partners around the country who want to bring our team there. And so if you're in Lexington or Louisville, and you have a group of people you're connected to in different parts of civic life, and you're like, hey, we think actually it would be beneficial to train a whole group of us here in Lexington to lead these gatherings, then you can reach out to our team and we can explore that. We recently did such trainings with a cohort from Flint, Michigan, with a different cohort from North Carolina. So that's one way. The other way is that our team right now is putting together essentially a multimedia Civic Saturday in a box toolkit that anybody can just go to our website and download without having to go through an in-person training, because not everybody has the time to do that, and both read materials, see videos of other Civic Saturdays and how they've unfolded in different parts of the country. There is a template, but how a Civic Saturday unfolds in Brownsville, Minnesota is super different from how it unfolds in Memphis. And so people will adapt the form to their own place. And so in the coming months, we will have that toolkit as well.
I want to talk about the language that you're using on the Citizen University website, and even in our conversation, you talk a lot about place, about character, civic faith and culture, civic love and joy. Tell us a little bit more about that language. I assume it's purposeful.
Oh, it is very purposeful. I mean, I think just let's start with two of the key words. Let's start even with the core word, citizen. Citizen University, citizenship. I think it is implicit, but I'll make it explicit. In our work, we are not talking about documentation status and United States passport holding, that sense of citizenship. We mean the broader ethical conception of being a member of the body, a contributor to community, someone who takes responsibility for their piece of the community. And we have a simple equation that we sometimes use to describe what we mean in that sense to live like a citizen. And the equation is power plus character equals citizenship. To live like a citizen in this broader sense requires both that you be literate in power, that you understand what power is, how it flows through your community, how you can be part of the flow, how you can redirect that flow, whether that's people power, ideas power, money power, social norms power, the power of numbers, the power of state action and government, the power of force and violence, which is out there now in more prominent ways, to be literate in power, but then to couple that fluency in power with a grounding in civic character, with a set of embodied habits and norms and values that are about not just looking out for yourself. They're about how shall we live together in a diverse community? How shall we sustain a community? How do you actually embody values of stewardship and service and contribution before consumption and sharing of burdens and sacrifices? These are nice words that only come to life in the little choices we make and in the habits of heart and mind, to use a Tocquevillian phrase, that we either commit to or don't. And so that language, power, character, citizenship, is super intentional for us. We have a worldview about what that means, both on an individual level and what each of us chooses to do every day, but also collectively. A big thrust of our language, our approach, is about civic culture. Look, like you, I know a lot about policy and the law, and I cut my teeth in my earlier part of my career in Washington, D.C., working on those things and understanding structural reform and the structures of policy and lawmaking. But because of that, I've come to believe firmly that as much as structure matters, culture precedes structure. Culture, the norms, values, habits, narratives, rituals that we all engage in, sometimes not consciously, that define what we think is okay and normal in how we live together. Civic culture defines the frame of the possible when it comes to structural reform and policy and so forth. And so if we have a civic culture that is nihilistic, short-term, hyper-individualistic, super self-centered, then, good luck keeping a republic. But if you actually have a civic culture rooted in place and relationship where people see each other, know each other, may not like each other, but commit to living with each other and solving problems together, then our experiment has a shot, right? And I think that emphasis on culture is another important part of the frameworks that we have.
We're speaking with Eric Liu of Citizen University. I'm so glad, Eric, that you mentioned civic culture, because this is something that my own research has really benefited from thinking about. I'm right now working on a project about non-voters and, this fact that, we celebrate strong turnout when, maybe half of us show up to an election. And what I've found is that there's some places, some states that seem to have a very strong civic culture, like Minnesota, I think, has a very strong culture of participation through its corporations, through its institutions, and through its people. And not surprisingly, it has very high turnout. Other states seem to have less connective tissue around civic culture. So how do we create and then sustain it?
Well, first of all, to rewind, I really love that you're thinking about non-voters and thinking about the kind of cultural context that leads people not to vote. I think part of one of the TED Talks that I've given is on this theme, in which I say there's no such thing as not voting. Mm-hmm. Not voting is voting. Mm-hmm. Not voting is voting to cede your power, hand your voice over to somebody else who will claim it and grab it and use it in your name. Now, that's not to shame or to scold, but it is to say that, it might seem like you can opt out, but you can't opt out. And that a system in which, as you say, often a majority of the eligible voters have opted out is still a system in which most of the people are telling us things are broken, things feel rigged. And if you actually want to do more than register that complaint, you have to be part of a culture that converts complaint into committed action. And that doesn't have to just be voting. It can be showing up in your neighborhood. It can be showing up to solve problems or mentor people or whatever. But I really love that you're thinking about that angle. And I think more people who care and know about voting and voting rights the way, to the extent that you do, the depth that you do, should be thinking about this through this wider lens.
And it's not apathy, right? This is one thing that really gets me, is that most people think non-voters are simply apathetic about the system. But I think apathy is a symptom, not a cause.
Yes, 100%. It is. You know, I mean, we should, one way we could change the culture is every election cycle, say the winner of this election once again was the non-voting bloc. You know, they outnumbered both the people who voted for candidate A and the people who voted for candidate B. You know, once again, they you know, the results of this election are that a plurality or even a majority of the eligible voters of Lexington, Louisville, Kentucky, the United States have deemed this system to be broken. And okay, as a consolation prize, candidate A, you know, is going to actually, you know, move on and take office. But we have a bigger problem here. And I think, you know, to your larger question about some states, some places have stronger connective tissue, you know, or healthier civic culture than others. I mean, that's a demonstrable fact. But that too is not a blame thing. That's not saying, therefore, oh, well, you know, Kentucky, come on, pick it up, be more like Minnesota, or, you know, Washington, why can't you be like Minnesota too, or whatever it is. Like, it's more of an invitation. This is another word I use a lot. Like, the way we shift the culture in a place around participation, engagement, responsibility taking is not to scold, but it is to invite. And the thing that you're inviting people into is not just, hey, want to join this thing that in which we're getting involved in this wonky process, but rather, hey, do you want to feel a little more powerful? Hey, do you want to feel like you're being seen? Hey, do you want to actually pull out of what's starting to feel like a life of social isolation? Hey, do you want to actually belong to something that you can start to feel proud of because you're making a tangible difference in your community? Come join us. And the join can be an electoral campaign. It can be a hyper-local civic action. But that spirit of invitation is one way we start to change that culture. You know, there's a whole other conversation, Josh, we could have about like the social history of the United States and why places like Minnesota, you know, have had a strong civic culture for generations. It actually, there's a literal lineage that mm-hmm. goes from New England across the upper Midwest to places like Washington and Seattle, where you have a strong bit of that early Puritan kind of small community, town meeting spirit. But in both actually Minneapolis and Minnesota and Washington, you then have this influx of both Scandinavian and Asian immigrants who created a strong, deep culture of collective responsibility. And, you know, that's a whole other interesting sociological thing, but that's the past. Like, I'm talking about the present, and whatever place you landed in, whatever its inherited social history might be, we all have the opportunity to choose right now to start showing up in new ways for each other.
So let's say you meet someone who's a non-voter. They tell you that they just don't care about politics. They don't have the time. They, you know, both sides are seemingly the same, so it doesn't matter who wins. And they just can't be bothered. What do you say to them in response?
I first affirm what they are feeling. You know, that what they're feeling is both real and pretty darn valid. And that the system does seem broken, and that, you know, though the parties are different in important ways, they are very similar in that they seem to not be responding to the deep pain that a lot of people are feeling. You know, and I think, look, Josh, I am of the view that all politics is pain relief. You know, and I mean, I'm not just talking about right now. Like, Donald Trump's success is partly attributable to his gift for identifying pain points and promising remedies. But the New Deal was pain relief. You know, the Civil Rights Movement was pain relief. And to put it in other contexts, the Klan was pain relief for white people who were starting to feel their status under threat and starting to feel like their place in the community was changing. And there were people who would appeal to them and say, we'll make you feel better about yourselves if you join this thing. And so what I'd say to a non-voter who feels this is, number one, like, your feelings, your pain is for real, and it's shared by tens of millions of Americans. But the second thing I'd say is, you have a choice now. Like, what are you going to do with your pain? Are you just going to curl up and kind of withdraw from the world? Or are you going to start finding some other people to find some affirmative ways to deal with this? And I'm not even going to push you to vote right now. Like, voting can be down the road if you're moved to do it. Voting, to me, happens when people already feel like they have an investment in the community and when the community has an investment in them. And so to me, the thing I would invite this person to do is let's find some low barrier, you know, low stakes ways to feel like you can be a little more invested in your block, in your neighborhood, and where other people around you can start feeling a little more invested in you because they now know you. They now will not walk past you or avoid eye contact with you. They'll be like, hey, what's going on, Josh? I haven't seen you in a few weeks. What's going on? Are you doing all right? What's happening? Right. And I think that human connection is the groundwork of anything you want to do in a democracy, including voting, but almost last of all, voting.
You're putting the finishing touches on a new book titled Live Like a Citizen, 8 Ways to Change Your Mindset and Our Country. Do you want to give us a little preview?
I will, Josh. This book grows out of not just the work that I do at Citizen University, but the hundreds of thousands of people I've encountered around the United States and who have shaped and changed me in the ways that I see things. And this book, the subtitle of it you named, kind of suggests this is not a book about electoral politics or even straight up political organizing or, you know, resistance actions or stuff like that. It is a book whose premise is we have a deeper problem, folks. We have a deeper problem in the United States, which is that we have forgotten how to be human. We have forgotten how to be and be with. And that is partly our super-mediated, polarized national politics. That's partly tech and AI. That's partly economic inequality that's stretching us apart and making us not feel like we're all in the same boat. It's a lot of reasons, but the bottom line is we are dehumanizing each other and being dehumanized by each other. And so the 8 kind of ways that I talk about in this book are 8 elemental verbs: how to see, how to listen, how to feel, how to join, how to fight, how to change, how to imagine, and how to commit. And these are all things that Americans, small town, big city, left, right, red, blue, whatever, have kind of forgotten how to do. And those habits have been disappearing for several generations now. And so this book is an attempt to kind of name these things, but also remind people when it seems like things are catastrophic and dystopian, and the problems are too big for any of us, that no, actually, if you can choose to start seeing people with new eyes, to start seeing your place with new eyes, and start asking questions about why things are the way they are on your block, if you can start listening in a new way to people, if you can start committing to joining, if you can keep limber in your heart and your head and sustain an ability to change your mind when encountering new things, these habits, which are not being rewarded by our culture of social media, these are the habits that we've got to cultivate. And that's what the book is about.
Wow, I can't wait to read this. This sounds like it's going to be so powerful and impactful for really reinvigorating what we've talked about this entire discussion, which is, you know, creating and sustaining a culture of civic participation. Eric Liu is the co-founder and CEO of Citizen University, which you can find at citizenuniversity.us. Eric, thank you for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
Josh, thank you so much, and thanks for all that you're doing.
Josh, as its website, citizenuniversity.us, says, its dream is a country in which Americans are steeped in a sense of civic character, educated in the tools of civic power, and are problem-solving contributors in a self-governing community. What do you think they mean by Americans steeped in a sense of civic character?
I love the way that Citizen University talks about the mission of democracy. Civic character, what does that mean? It means that we all recognize we have an important role to play, and we need to be active in doing so. But it's not just about voting. I mean, I love how they discuss the power of community engagement beyond voting. Voting's the easy part. Once we get people involved in their society, involved in their community, then they're certainly more likely to show up to vote when elections come around. It's really about who you are as a person and how you navigate through society that makes the biggest difference. We talk a lot about people having character. You know, who are people of character? To discuss civic character demonstrates that that is an important component of living in a democracy.
And so what they're advocating for is what is actually happening on the ground in Lexington with the civic assembly.
Yeah, it's a great example of putting into practice some of these ideals that Citizen University is espousing. This civic assembly, comprised of 36 residents from Lexington, chosen, you know, randomly through a civic lottery, but demographically representative of the city, to all get in a room together and talk about important issues of local democracy, is the exact kind of thing that can help to create a civic culture. And so, you know, what Citizen University is talking about on the national scale, but trying to implement in communities all around the country, I'm really proud that Lexington has started down that path through Civic Lex and through the Civic Assembly.
We'll have more on that in a moment. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a series produced by WEKU and Eastern Standard in partnership with Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and if you just joined us, Democracy Optimist explores current conditions across the American civic landscape. Our series is hosted by Joshua Douglas, a research professor of election law and voting rights at the University of Kentucky's Rosenberg College of Law. We just heard from Eric Liu, CEO and co-founder of Citizen University, a nonprofit organization promoting civic empowerment. And at the end of their conversation, Eric and Josh mentioned an exciting exercise in real grassroots democracy that's unfolding right now in Lexington, Kentucky. And that is the focus of our next guest. Here again is Josh Douglas.
This spring, something unique is happening in Lexington, Kentucky. 36 individuals are gathering for public meetings and debate on a topic that might seem arcane, but impacts all of us: potential revisions to the city charter. This is the ultimate exercise in how the sausage gets made. But this time, it's being made by a representative cross-section of the community. It's a one-of-a-kind exercise in hyper-local democracy, and it's being watched all over the country as a potential model for how to truly involve people in government. Here to discuss this upcoming civic assembly in Lexington, Kentucky, is Richard Young. Richard is the founder and executive director of Civic Lex, a nonprofit dedicated to strengthening civic health that is running the assembly. Now we will dive into the details of the civic assembly. Full disclosure, I'm on the board of Civic Lex and also serve on the advisory board for this civic assembly. Richard, welcome back to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me, Josh.
So first, let's tell us the origins of this civic assembly. How did this whole idea come about?
Sure. So the civic assembly has been in a planning stage for actually the past 3 years. We got it kicked off with a conversation with the Urban County Council, where a couple members approached us about potentially running a process to look at the city charter and evaluate if anything needs to change. And we were interested, but we wanted to try out a new process that really removed us as an organization from making those sorts of qualitative decisions and really put it in the hands of the public. And so we'd been familiar with civic assemblies or citizens assemblies, as they're sometimes called, for a while. They've been used over 700 times worldwide to make very important decisions. And we thought it could be a really interesting model for focusing on the city charter because it really allows participants to go deep into an issue. You know, I'm sure we'll get into the structure of the assembly in a minute, but it is an intensive amount of time. You know, the participants are going to be committing about 30 hours, 35 hours to this process. And that amount of time really allows them to dig deep into an issue that might be a little bit confusing on its face, you know, or not confusing, but just, you know, it's not a common issue that people are talking about, although it has pretty significant repercussions for the community. And so this, unlike any other public engagement process where, you know, you're trying to reach a lot of people with, you know, a small amount of information and trying to get people's feedback on things that they recognize in their daily life, this is something that is quite niche, quite potent, has a lot of ramifications, and because of that requires a bit of a deeper dive from the public.
So let's talk a little bit more about that public engagement part of this? You know, you said you wanted to remove CivicLex as the driving organization, instead really rely on the people, the residents of the city, to do this work. So tell us how that has impacted the approach of everything that you've planned.
When we were first settling into this idea of doing a civic assembly on the city charter, we needed to understand which of the topics in the charter we wanted to focus on. Because any change to the city charter has to go up for a public ballot referendum, we wanted to make sure, you know, we had a cap of how many we could do. And so we wanted to make sure that we were focusing on a number of topics in the assembly that would be doable and achievable and potentially changeable. And so we did a large-scale public engagement process where we attended, you know, dozens of community events. We had a survey out that, you know, around 850 Lexington residents responded to that were, you know, the goal of that survey and that whole process was to try and distill down, you know, what are the topics that people would be the most interested in this assembly focusing on? And so from the 8 or 10 topics, we ended up coming down to 2. We took the topic that had the most sort of unanimity around, where the public most agreed with each other, and that was on how frequently the charter should be reviewed. About 74% of residents that responded to our survey said that the charter should be reviewed regularly. And we also looked at the one that was the most divided, the one where the public had the closest split between votes. And in that survey, we found that that topic was the compensation of our council members, which has a lot of ramifications. You know, how much our council members are compensated impacts who can serve on council, which therefore impacts trust, participation, representation, all of the things that we're trying to focus on with our assembly. And so that topic, 43% of the public thought that council compensation should be increased, and 42% thought it should stay the same. And so we have these two topics that were, you know, where we have this really pretty robust set of public perspectives on. And we decided to go with the one that the people were the most divided on and the one that the people were the most, you know, cohesive on.
And of course, the compensation piece, you know, has been in the news given the number of current city council members who have announced they're not running for re-election and have cited compensation, you know, for what is paid as a part-time job, but, you know, they felt like has been full-time responsibilities. So we keep talking about, you know, the civic assembly, but let's just get into the details. So there's 36 people who are meeting throughout the month to discuss these two issues of the city charter, which, again, I think we can think of the city charter sort of like the city's constitution. So
exactly.
These 36 individuals are meeting to discuss two potential changes to the city's governing document. How do we get to these 36 people? Why are these the people that are going to get to decide this thing?
So when you're trying to build an assembly, you know, you want to have a large enough body of people where you can have a real diversity of opinion and diversity of thought. But you don't want too large of a body because it becomes unwieldy, unless you're doing one nationwide like has happened in Ireland and many other countries. So we settled on 36 because Lexington has 12 council districts and we wanted to make it a sort of multiple of 12. And how we selected those 36 residents is one of the most distinguishing factors about a civic assembly versus any other type of public engagement. So typically in any public engagement process, right, it's who shows up to the process. You can take a lot of steps to try and reach new people and you know, hold meetings in different places and try and get as much information from a broad set of people as you can. But the way the assembly works is actually quite different. Instead of counting on who shows up, we try and select this group of 36 people using a very complicated process that's called sortition. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we sent out 10,000 mailers to 10,000 randomly selected residential addresses in Lexington.
I'm still mad I didn't get one.
I'm so sorry. I've heard that from many people. So, you know, apartments, homes, anywhere that was a residential address in Lexington, we got that data from the Fayette County PVA's office. So shout out to them for their help. And we sent these 10,000 postcards, and on the postcards was basically it's like a Willy Wonka golden ticket, right? Like, you have been selected to participate in this process. This is how you apply if you want to do it. And there's a, you know, a QR code in the website and a phone number if you need to do that. And so we ended up having about 380, 400 people actually end up applying. And, you know, the typical response rate for these internationally is about 2-3%. So we felt pretty good about that. And then from that group of, you know, 380 or so people, we got their demographic information. We took that demographic information and we put it into this software called Panelot, like Camelot, but Panelot, to produce what's called a panel. And the panel is the people that serve on the assembly. And so what we do is we took all of the demographic information of Lexington across 9 demographic categories. So age, race, income, homeownership status, political party, a variety of them, and their affiliation with Civic Lex. We wanted to make sure that there weren't, you know, there's weren't that many people that already knew about Civic Lex. And we took that data, we put it into Panelot, and then we took all of our applicant data anonymized and put it in there. And basically what Panelot does is it makes as many combinations as possible that would be statistically representative of your community. So if your community is 50% men, 50% women, it will generate a panel that's 50% men, 50% women. If you have a lot of demographics in there, in our case, 9, it will produce as many panels as possible where the population of that panel, the 36 people in our case, as closely as possible match the demographics of Lexington across all 9 of those categories. And so we ended up getting 204 panels. And then from that, we wrote every number on a little ball and put it in a bingo cage. And we spun a bingo cage and we picked one out at random. And it was panel number 24. And so what that means is that the people that are serving on the Civic Assembly were chosen by lottery. They were chosen randomly, right? It was random mailings to random addresses, random applications from those random addresses, a set of random panels from the random applicants, and then drawing randomly one of the random panels of the random number of panels. So there's a lot of different ways to get it so that we weren't, you know, that we weren't hand-selecting people, right? These are all people that were chosen by, like, a quadruple lottery.
So a lot of randomness in the system and yet still demographically consistent with Lexington's population. So just give us a couple of these, like, the you know, the youngest person on the assembly.
Yeah, so we have folks all the way up in their 80s. We have someone that is under 18. We are, you know, almost exactly matched across all of our demographics. We feel really good about it. We have, you know, so many Republicans, so many Democrats, so many independents, so many people that aren't registered. We have, you know, so many folks of, you know, all of the sort of, you know, races in Lexington plus multiracial. We have, our split is almost exactly a third, third, third for the way that the census categorizes income. So, you know, the sort of full income range broken down into thirds. I mean, it is, it's pretty amazing. You know, we were like all really nervous because we did the drawing live on Facebook Live. We streamed it because we wanted to make sure that people saw, like, this is really random.
Ultimate transparency.
Ultimate transparency. And so, you know, we drew the ball and we read off the names live. And, you know, it was a little nerve-wracking because we're like, okay, we know we followed all the best practices. We know we've done all of our due diligence. But when those names were being read off, those names were being read off. And so if the panel didn't, you know, if something had gone wrong somewhere along the line, that would have been fully out there for people to see. And so it was a little stressful for us. But ultimately, the panel that we ended up with is really great. And so we have these 36 people. We've had a few that have not been able to do it. And we have a statistical approach for selecting the most similar person along all 9 demographics from the rest of our pool. And they'll all start meeting here at the beginning of March.
All right, so a little radio magic here. We're chatting before the assembly has actually begun, but this will air and it's already underway when people are listening. So do you have predictions as kind of what will have happened at the beginning of the assembly?
You know, I honestly don't know what to expect. I think it is going to be, you know, it's going to be a really fascinating experiment in what it looks like to take folks that have maybe never participated in a civic process before. Certainly folks that don't know what the charter is. I don't know if anyone really knows what the charter is except for like 8 people. and, you know, and really give them a pretty significant amount of authority and decision-making power over a really important but very dense document. You know, like we've been on the phone a lot with our panelists and emailing, and you know, I think and their excitement is pretty infectious. Mm-hmm. Like they really seem very excited to participate in this process and to be asked to do it. You know, I think, again, so much of public engagement in local democracy work is who shows up. And this is such a different approach because it is about inviting people to show up, and inviting very specific people. And the other thing, we haven't quite talked about this, but another important distinction about this process is that all of the participants will be compensated. Mm-hmm. So we are compensating each person $1,200 for their time. And then we also have childcare and transportation stipends available. And to some, we'll end up providing transportation ourselves if the stipend won't work. You know, this is really about trying to take as many barriers as possible out of the way for people to really genuinely participate in a process that really wants their involvement. Mm-hmm. It is designed for them to be in control and for them to make the ultimate decision about what happens.
So we're all so polarized these days. I mean, at least our political discourse, especially at the national level, is so polarized. And that sometimes trickles down to the state level and even the local level. So, you know, might these 36 people just spend the entire time squabbling with each other?
Well, we certainly hope not. We have a facilitator who's an incredibly gifted facilitator here in our community, who's going to be, you know, making sure it'll be her job to make sure that that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think when it comes to issues like the city charter, which is, again, I mean, it sounds boring, but it does have really massive implications for our community, depending on what part of it you are looking at. You know, local issues tend to be a little less tense for people than national issues. I mean, that's something that we experience a lot in our work. We have people from all sorts of different political perspectives come to our events. You know, the assembly by its definition will have will be, you know, proportionally representative to the political persuasions of Lexington, which is a pretty, you know, is a politically contested space. It's not, you know, 90% one party. And so I think what our observations have been, and I expect that this will be the same thing will be true with the assembly. When people are given an opportunity to really shape their own community, and when it's not, you know, one of the big hot button issues, people from different perspectives, vastly different perspectives, can find common ground and can find an opportunity to connect and work together. It was so interesting as we were selecting our topics, we were going through and looking at the survey data that we got back. And even, you know, along part of what we asked people was their political, you know, their political registration, because we wanted to see and their sort of self-identified ideology separate from the registration, because we wanted to see, you know, did these topics resonate differently with folks that are registered for different parties or see themselves as, you know, very progressive or very conservative? And what we found is that they didn't really fall into neat camps, right? On any one issue, you couldn't really predict what someone's perspective on that issue is going to be based on their political registration or their political ideology. Because I think just at the local level, not all issues, but many issues just don't fall neatly into those camps. And I think it reflects that people have a lot more nuance in their political thinking than we tend to give them credit for.
So once the assembly is over and these 36 individuals have made recommendations about changing the city charter, assuming they do recommend some changes, it then goes to city council for the city council to decide whether to put it on the ballot for this November. So ultimately, voters of Lexington will have the final say?
Yes. So council has adopted a resolution committing themselves to meaningfully responding to the assembly recommendations. For us, that's a really important signifier to our assembly members that their deliberation is going to be listened to and valued. You know, these people, again, 36 hours across six sessions in the month of March. That's a lot of time that people could be spending with their family, reading a book, doing, you know, many other things.
Listening to public radio.
Yeah, listening to Democracy Optimist. And they're giving that time freely. We want to make sure that that time is honored, even beyond the compensation, even beyond all the other barriers. Like, we want to make sure that they feel like what they have done is respected and listened to by our legislative body. So that is what we asked the council to commit to, and they've committed to it. If, you know, we've also asked them to commit to not changing the recommendations. So we want the recommendations, if they come forward, to be put on the ballot as is. Mm-hmm. So any change to the city charter has to be adopted by ballot measure. The last time that happened, or that this was even attempted, was in 1998. And the sole ballot amendment that came out of an externally led charter review commission got pretty walloped at the ballot box. We'll see what happens. But I think ultimately the power to make decisions about what goes on the ballot is in the hands of our assembly members. And then the decision about what happens on the ballot is in the hands of the public.
So let's zoom out real quick to ask what the national landscape looks like. I mean, are people nationally paying attention to what's happening in Lexington and the Civic Assembly?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we, to say that we get a lot of incoming questions and communications from national organizations, national philanthropy groups, would be an understatement. There's a lot of, I think everyone in our country recognizes that we're having a lot of trouble making decisions, right? If you look at what's happening in our federal government, where, Congress struggles to barely even adopt bipartisan legislation that everyone can, for the most part, agree on. We need to be looking at new ways of governing ourselves and making decisions that remove some of the political disincentives from it, right? That sort of insulate people from this like partisan rancor that we are experiencing right now. And so we're getting a lot of incoming communication because of that, because citizens' assemblies or civic assemblies are seen as one of those potential models. And there are a number of them happening across the country. But I think one of the things that's sort of special about ours is that it is a local organization that's doing it. It's not a national or international organization coming in and running a process in a community they may or may not know particularly well. We have a stake in the future of this, because if this doesn't go well, people are going to get mad at Civic Lex, and like, fair enough. So that means we really want to do it right. We really want to put all of our energy into making this the best possible version of itself that it can be. Is it going to be perfect? Absolutely not. But what we are hoping for is a meaningful glimpse that others can learn from at what it looks like for a community to decide its own future in a better way. And that's what we think the Civic Assembly could be.
If that's not optimism about local democracy, then I don't know what is. Richard Young is the executive director of Civic Lex, which is running the first ever Lexington Civic Assembly this spring. Richard, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me.
Josh, I think it's important to emphasize how important this civic assembly is. You mentioned that it's being watched all over the country as a potential model for how to truly involve people in government. Do you think that this very transparent, very grassroots exercise might even restore some faith in democracy, maybe remind people what's at stake?
Yeah, I'm so excited for this initiative. I jumped at the chance to serve on the advisory board when Richard came to me with the idea, because this is really everything that we're all about here in this series of Democracy Optimist, in my scholarship. It's the power of people, right? Democracy is not about those people in Washington, D.C., or even in Frankfurt. It's about all of us. And it's about the way that we can engage with each other in trying to find a better way to organize our society. So I think it's just really a great exercise to get people from all walks of life, from all different demographics, from all over Lexington, in a room together to talk about issues that really impact the way local government works. I do think it should be a model for, civil discourse, for how we can talk to each other, but also about how we sustain democracy at the local level. I've said all the time that democracy is not a spectator sport. And here we have people gathering, actually involved, and they're not, people who are in power or who have, a ton of moneyed interest behind them. They're everyday people, and they're the ones who are getting to make these decisions.
And, you know, I think it's really important here to repeat something that we heard Richard say, and that is that this action, the Civic Assembly, has city council buy-in. In other words, it's not just people just talking. There could be some action that comes out of it.
Absolutely. The goal here is if the Civic Assembly decides there should be some changes to the city charter, to put those before the city council. And then the city council has already said that they're at least committed to putting that on the ballot. So hopefully they would follow through with that. And the voters of Lexington will get to decide whether to approve or not approve of these changes to the charter. So, you know, yes, it's not just people getting in a room and talking about important issues. They actually have power here. They actually have agency to make a change to how local democracy works.
And so this adds a new layer to local democracy.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's a combination of just the people through a referendum deciding something, but doing so through the structure we already have in city council and a structured way to have these conversations. You know, you and I could just go to the coffee shop and talk about a change we want in government, but how do we actually put that into implementation? Now Civic Lex, through the Civic Assembly, has created a structure to make that happen. And we don't know what's going to come out of the Civic Assembly.
Right.
That's really the other exciting thing. You know, they might decide that they want to, you know, have charter revisions, you know, every however many years or once every 10 years. We just have no idea. They might say that city council pay should go up. It should stay the same. But this is the sort of thing that the people themselves are going to get to decide first through the assembly and then ultimately in November through the electorate.
This is going to be really interesting to follow.
It sure is. And the public can also watch everything. I mean, everything is transparent and open, so people can go and watch the meetings. And I plan to be there for at least some of this to see the kinds of deliberations that are happening.
Josh Douglas, host of our ongoing series, Democracy Optimist. I'm Tom Martin, Eastern Standard's senior editor and host and producer of Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas is our series writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer, Eli Raymond and Landon Palmer, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist's theme song, American, is by Madeline Peru. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.